prevention. Actually, we know what is the impact of genocide, what is the impact on human rights of warfare. We have lived it ourselves. So Colombia takes very seriously our commitments on the Convention on Genocide. And that convention calls countries, states that are part of the convention to not enable the means towards genocide. So an energy embargo means that parties and countries become responsible for not allowing the means to Israel to commit that genocide. And that's why that's the legal framework. There is also an international court justice resolution this year, sentence this year, that is calling what's happening in Israel and Gaza a genocide. So there is a legal framework for states to act, and that's why the Colombian government is calling other states to not allow and provide the means for a genocide that is happening in life. We can all see it, and that is actually tremendous on the most vulnerable people.
Minister Mohammed, you're the head of the delegation here. President Petro didn't come. Why not?
President Petro canceled at last minute because 1 week after COP16 in Colombia, we had very, very strong rainfall and flooding with one of our states or departamentos, 85% flooded in the most vulnerable area in the country. So he had to attend that situation, and it's a paradox because basically it is because of climate change that we are having these effects that affect the most vulnerable people.
And finally, next year, the COP30 will be in Brazil. I've got two questions. One is, you were head of COP16, the Biodiversity Convention in Cali. How that's different from this COP, what was being achieved, and then here, the COP is coming for the first time right to the Amazon, and what that means as a sister country in Latin America.
Yes, we have worked with the Brazilian government. We call it the route from Cali to Belém, because actually it's 2 years of these COPs in Latin America. It's an extraordinary opportunity for a region to show a different path that puts humanity and nature at the center. Cali was an exemplary COP, because we call it a people's COP. And it actually shows how diversity, how the voices of those that are in the front lines of the problem can influence the environment of negotiation, can create empowerment and participation from the diversity of voices. And to solve these issues, climate, biodiversity, which is the loss of nature, which are actually interconnected, we need the knowledge of everybody, and we need the experience, the whole human experience. We cannot undervalue anybody. And also, COP16 in Cali achieved something that so far has not been achieved here. We have created a new source of funding for biodiversity, which is the Cali Fund. And it's a fund that we collect money from the private sector that is using genetic resources when they are in digital databases. They have to contribute now to this multilateral fund that then will be redistributed to the countries that have the biodiversity to protect it. So actually, the Cali COP was very successful in creating this new funding source for global biodiversity to make the private sector paid for the use of those resources and to convert private money into public money that can actually now protect a common good.
What exactly does biodiversity mean, and why does it matter?
Actually, biodiversity is the diversity of life, and it is all the species that interlinked into what we call the web of life make our planet a living planet, create the ecosystem that provides all the sources of life for everybody to live, including humans. We forget that we are part of the biosphere. We are just not aliens that arrive here and are separated. And that's why when every species that is extincted breaks that chain of life and creates an impact. And some scientists said, because that of human intervention, we are now entering the sixth global extinction of a species. It has happened 5 times before in the history of the planet, and we could be entering the sixth, but this time because of the influence of one species with the human beings. So biodiversity COP is about the convention on how to protect the diversity of life on Earth and how to protect nature.
That's Susana Muhammad, Colombia's environment minister, who chairs Colombia's climate delegation here at COP29 in Baku. Coming up, we question Azerbaijan's deputy foreign minister, the COP29 lead negotiator, about Azerbaijan's crackdown on civil society. Stay with us.
The feeling of machines is not pleasure, not the weather, not the baby, not sex, not feather on spine, not organs or the mind, not feather on spine, not organs.
Machines by Reverend Billy and the Church of Stop Shopping Choir. Next month, they'll be debuting Extinction, the musical, at Joe's Pub in New York City. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. Earlier today, Democracy Now! Attended the news conference of the COP presidency. It was led by Azerbaijan's deputy foreign minister, Yalcin Rafiev, who's also the COP29 lead negotiator. I asked him a question.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! News. Thank you so much for making the COP presidency available to the press. Many journalists and climate activists have been arrested here in Azerbaijan in the lead up to the COP, including the anti-corruption economist, Gubad Ibadoglu, who's called for greater transparency in oil and gas revenues, and climate activists like Anar Mamadli, who co-founded a climate justice group weeks before the COP. My question is, will they, among many other arrests in this lead up to the COP, be freed? Why were they arrested? And since it's tourism day here at the COP, don't you think that this is a great threat to tourism when you have a crackdown like this in a country?
Thank you. Surely I'm not going to comment on any ongoing judicial processes. We are here all to make a collective effort for the sake of humanity to agree and adopt important decisions on climate action. And I'm sure with the determination of the parties, we will get there. I would be more than happy to answer any questions related to climate and the ongoing negotiations. Thank you.
They are climate activists, climate economists.
We continue.
After the news conference, I caught up with Yalcin Rafiev of Azerbaijan, representing the COP presidency, as he spoke with journalists outside the room. Sir, could you comment on the climate activists who've been arrested?
He's got quite a busy schedule.
Yes, so I understand. As Azerbaijan's chief negotiator moved quickly down the hall, I followed up. Could I just get one quick comment from you on the arrests of the climate activists and the journalists in the lead up to this COP?
I have clearly answered your question. Thank you. I'm sorry that I'm running out of the meeting.
You said it's not related to climate, but they're climate activists and economists and looking at the gas and oil sector. Just a brief answer from the press. That was Azerbaijan's chief negotiator representing the COP presidency here at COP29. As I tried to catch up with him after to follow up on my question on the crackdown and the press and climate justice activists in this lead up to the COP, he had said that my question was irrelevant at the news conference, and now he said he was too busy to answer it, although he did stop to answer other journalists' questions. That That was Azerbaijan's deputy foreign minister, Yalcin Rafiev, who's also the COP29 lead negotiator. As we broadcast from the UN Climate Summit here in Baku, Azerbaijan, we continue to look at the brutal crackdown on human rights activists, government critics, and the press. In the months ahead of hosting COP29, the Azerbaijani government arrested a number of independent journalists, including three women journalists with the outlet Absas Media, who said they were assaulted earlier this month at a Baku jail while awaiting trial. Since November of last year, at least six journalists with Absas have been arrested. For more, we're going to Berlin, where we're joined by Leyla Mustafayeva. Acting editor-in-chief of Absas Media, the online news site, has been working out of Berlin due to the crackdown here in Azerbaijan. Leyla, thank you for joining us. You can see that the deputy foreign minister was not willing to talk about the crackdown here, but talk about first what have happened to the women journalists, well, all six journalists of Absas in this lead-up to the COP.
Thank you for having me in the program. So actually, the total crackdown on Azerbaijani media started recently, last year in November. Our news organization, Absas Media, was targeted massively, and six of our journalists, including director Ulvi Hasanli, Sevinç Vakifkızı, editor-in-chief, and two brave journalists, Nergis Absalamova and Elnare Gasimova, also the project manager, Mehmet Kegalov, and including the investigative journalist Hafiz Babali was detained on fabricated charges. These journalists are accused in smuggling foreign currency into the country. And they are facing right now from 8 to 12 years imprisonment because in late August this year, the investigator has aggravated the case and added seven more criminal charges against the journalists. And they are still in jail since once year, just detained one year ahead of COP, and facing harassment and death threat in jail as well. Just a few months ago, our director, Ulvi Hasanli, was threatened with death just for making the torture cases public from the prison where he is kept. And also our three brave female journalists, Sevinç Vagifkızı, Nergis Absalamova, and also Elnara Gasimova, has faced violence just a few days ahead COP in a prison which is just kilometers away from the COP venue.
I'm asking you, Leyla, about the decision to host the COP29 here. Absas also conducted investigations looking at who in the Azerbaijani government has benefited from hosting the COP here in Baku.
Yes, they did. Actually, our journalists have been detained for this corruption investigations that they were doing on those here. It was the only media outlet carrying out systematic corruption investigations in the country. But for now, it was not just in vain to jail these journalists at COP because they were going to ask critical questions. Those state officials who is attending in COP29 conference in Baku, including Yalcin Rafiev, deputy foreign minister, who is lead negotiator of COP29 from Azerbaijan. In one of our investigations, we found out that Yalcin Rafiev's brother has lucratively won the tenders in related to reconstruction in Karabakh, despite the fact that the company had violated the environmental regulations. But it could be just one of the questions that our journalists could ask if they would be in freedom and could attend in COP29 conference as well. But in general, this is an event that Azerbaijan authorities are greenwashing their image because this is a conference, this is a country which the export of the country heavily relies on fossil fuels, namely gas and oil. And additionally, it was a good opportunity for Azerbaijan authorities just to have a lot of fossil fuel lobbyists in order to have a lot of contracts for gas and oil exportation.
We only have a few minutes, and I want to quickly ask you about the women at your news organization. Three of them have said that they were brutalized in pre-trial detention in a Baku jail. Can you explain what happened, who they were?
Just a few days ago, they were oppressed by the prison guardians, due to this instruction coming from the prison governor. They just wanted to have a fresh air in the cells where they are kept. They just stretched their hands out of the prison, small prison door window, in order to make sure that the door is not closed, and all the women who have health problems in jail with them to have fresh air. So, you know, the kind of topics related to air pollution or environmental issues are discussed in COP29 conference. But our journalists, they can't just mail or receive a fresh air in the prison.
Leila, in my last question to you, in June of 2023, Abcess journalists were arrested for investigating the Gedabek gold mine in Western Azerbaijan. A consortium of reporters led by Forbidden Stories later continued their investigation, which found that gold from Azerbaijan is brought to Europe and sold to tech giants like Apple, Tesla, and Microsoft. This is a clip.
June 2023, protests in Azerbaijan were violently crushed. Journalists capturing and publishing footage of these events were arrested, imprisoned, and even threatened with rape. A few months later, Abzaz media journalists who had covered these demonstrations were arrested again. To this day, they are still detained. In the meantime, Forbidden Stories took over their investigations to tell the stories they could no longer pursue. This investigation has led us to some of the biggest names in tech and banking.
We're talking about Microsoft, Tesla, and other giants of the tech or the industry. I'm not sure they are aware about what's going on in the mine where they are buying the gold through the raffinery.
Another person mentioned in this Forbidden Stories documentary is John Sununu, the former governor of New Hampshire, the father of the current governor, Chris Sununu. John Sununu also served as President George H.W. Bush's chief of staff. He's one of the shareholders in Anglo-Asian Mining, AAM, a gold mining company in Azerbaijan. What did Abcess Media discover about the work of this mining company in this last 60 seconds we have?
One of our journalists, Nagiz Absalamov, was covering the protests which broke out related to the gold mining and construction of Cyanide Lake in this village, which is actually put under police control currently. The Abzaz Media covered this protest and was going also to hold an independent water and soil test in order to see whether this complaint of coming from the residents or not. But they were jailed, unfortunately, and they couldn't just carry out independent tests in order to find out whether the soil and air was polluted with cyanide or not. They are just jailed, and it was one of the purposes just to silence the journalists, to prevent them from doing further investigation related to this gold mine in Western province in Azerbaijan.
Leila Mustafavaya, thank you so much for being with us. Acting Editor-in-Chief of the award-winning Azerbaijani independent media outlet Abcess Media, the online news site, has been working from outside Azerbaijan. Six of their journalists were arrested and imprisoned in the lead-up to this climate summit. Leila was speaking to us from Berlin, Germany. Coming up, Donald Trump has picked the former head of World Wrestling Entertainment to be Secretary of Education, and Dr. Mehmet Oz to run the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. He is a backer of privatizing Medicare. Back in 20 seconds. the Clowns, covered by Grace Jones. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We end today's show looking at President-elect Trump's latest nominees. Trump has nominated billionaire Linda McMahon to head the Department of Education, which Trump has pledged to shut down. McMahon is the former CEO of World Wrestling Entertainment. She headed the Small Business Administration during Trump's first term. She gave at least $15 million to a pro-Trump PAC during this election. She and her husband, Vince McMahon, were recently sued for failing to stop a WWE ringside announcer from sexually assaulting young boys. Vince McMahon also has been sued by a former WWE employee who accused him of sexual assault and of trafficking her to other men. We're joined now by the education historian, Diane Ravitch, who served as Assistant Secretary of Education under President George H.W. Bush. Diane Ravitch, thanks so much for joining us. In these few minutes we have with you, talk about this latest nomination by President-elect Trump. Talk about McMahon.
Well, I had to learn about her because she is not someone who's been engaged in the field of education at all. She led the Small Business Administration in the previous Trump term. President-elect Trump has a habit of choosing people who have either a desire to destroy the department or who have no experience. She falls into the latter category. She does not have any experience in education, although she was spent 1 year on the Connecticut State Board of Education, but otherwise she's a businesswoman. She would have been well qualified to head the Commerce Department, and apparently that's the job she wanted. But her job now, according to Project 2025 and everything that Trump has said, is to eliminate the Department of Education. She is not qualified to run the department because she doesn't know anything about it. And it's hard to say whether or not Congress will go along with the president's desire. He cannot single-handedly abolish the Department of Education. This is something that has to be done, if at all, by Congress.
Well, let me ask you something. She gave more than $7 million to two pro-Trump super PACs in 2016. As well, this year, gave $10 million to the Make America Great Again PAC. President Trump says, we will send education back to the states and Linda will spearhead that effort. What would it mean if the Department of Education were shut down?
Well, what Project 2025 says is that they're going to block grant all the federal funding. What that means is that they will take whatever money is currently going to the states, send it to the states with no strings. So right now, when a state gets money for Title I, it goes to schools that have a lot of poor children. When they get money for children with disabilities, it goes to schools that have children with disabilities. With the block granting, which is what they have in mind, there would be no strings attached. They could divert that money for other purposes. So Project 2025 says that at some point the federal funding was simply stopped. And they're really saying to the states, we're going to take away your federal funding. Here it is. You can have it now. But eventually it will dry up and you'll have to take care of your own federal monies, or not federal monies, make it up from state monies. What that means is basically going back to 1965, where there were vast inequities among the states, which was the reason for passing federal aid to education. It was an equity measure, and that equity measure will be wiped out.
A final question. This from the New York Times. She's played an influential role in laying the groundwork for a second Trump presidency as the chair of America First Policy Institute, which has set out a more immediate list of changes it says could be achieved through vastly changing the department's priorities. Those include stopping schools from promoting inaccurate and unpatriotic concepts, quote unquote, about American history surrounding institutionalized racism and expanding voucher programs. She's always talked about being pro-choice, not in terms of abortion, but in terms of privatizing schools.
That's unfortunately continuing a trend that started long ago under, I guess, Reagan, although Reagan was not able to do anything to make it happen. But choice got embedded into No Child Left Behind. with the charter school movement, and then the charter school movement turned into the voucher movement, and there now about half of the states, almost all of them red states, do have voucher programs. And these voucher programs enroll children who are predominantly well-to-do. They're not helping kids who are poor. Most of the kids who take vouchers never attended a public school. So the voucher program is a subsidy for kids who are already in private and religious schools. And it's been a tremendous boon for religious schools. And when you add that to the Supreme Court having lowered the bar for religious, for sending public money to religious institutions, we're heading towards a wipeout for the wall of separation between church and state. I think that when
education Linda historian Diane Ravitch, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for being with us. We're going to have to leave it there. We're going to continue to look at this. Former Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush. But we're going to turn right now to President-elect Trump's pick for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, Dr. Mehmet Oz, the well-known TV personality. CMS is the agency that oversees health coverage for 150 million people, part of the Department of Health and Human Services. Last week, Trump picked the prominent vaccine skeptic Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to head HHS. Dr. Oz unsuccessfully ran for the Senate from Pennsylvania in 2022, backer of privatizing Medicare. We are joined right now by Dr. Robert Steinbrück, director of Public Citizens Health Research Group. In these 2 minutes we have left, Dr. Steinbrück, talk about the significance of Oz, if he's approved, to head CMS.
Thank you for having me. It's a strange choice. Dr. Oz is a physician, which is good, but his background really has nothing to do with the Center for Medicare's and Medicaid Services. It touches half the country in terms of providing medical care. It's a complex bureaucratic organization, which also has regulatory structures. Dr. Oz is a celebrity physician. He's promoted various treatments and supplements of a dubious value, but that's really not what CMS is about. It's not the FDA. And it remains to be seen how he could be effective in this position if he's confirmed. The one thing I'll mention is that Dr. Oz, specific to CMS, is he's a supporter of Medicare Advantage and increasing privatization of Medicare. Medicare Advantage already covers about 54% of people under Medicare, and we think that's the wrong way to go. We'd like to see traditional Medicare strengthened so that there would be a level playing field. Medicare Advantage often overcharges the federal government, and it's strengthening it, making it even more lucrative for private insurers is not the way to go.
Dr. Robert Steinbrück, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Public Citizen Health Research Group Director. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with a remarkable team. Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Hannah Elias, and Dennis Moynihan. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grand, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Madeliana Ozbeck, Emily Anderson. To continue to watch our coverage of COP29 here in Baku, Azerbaijan, we'll be here for the whole week. Go to democracynow.org. Tomorrow is Women's Day here at the UN Summit, and we'll be bringing you women from around the world. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Listen to Home of Burnaby Rock, CJSF's Lux Rock Electronic Show. 2 hours of relative power each and every Friday, 6 to 8 p.m., and repeats every Thursday, 10 to midnight, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM. Do it.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse. Independent. Yours.